Hello and welcome to Podiatric's Paediatric Podcasts. Today we're going to be talking about failure to pass meconium. So this frequently turns up in exams, so it's worth knowing the common things that can present as failure to pass meconium. We will start with the case. So we've got a child born at 40 weeks gestation. Their weight is 3.5 kilograms. It was a normal delivery with no complications, and they didn't pass meconium within the first 48 hours. They vomited on day one of life, and they had increasing abdominal distension and reluctance to feed. They had an abdominal film that showed numerous loops of dilated bowel, and because with an abdominal x-ray in newborns, they lack the normal haustra, it's very difficult to say if that dilated bowel was small or large bowel. So they had a barium enema that showed that most of the dilated bowel was actually large bowel, and there was no transition zone, and we'll talk about why that's important later on. So what happened was the surgeons saw this patient and they had anal dilatation. And the infant then passed gas and meconium, and all their symptoms got better. The abdominal distension got better, the vomiting got better. They were then discharged from the hospital and kind of had the same sort of problems. So the wasn't opening his bowels as much, the abdomen was becoming more distended. And they had to come back into hospital then for more investigation. So they actually repeated the barium enema, and they had a transition zone in the distal part of the sigmoid colon, with basically, as you would imagine, the descending colon being quite big and the left-hand side of the transverse colon. So basically backing up proximal to that point. So you can imagine what goes before the sigmoid colon is your descending colon and the left side of the transverse colon. And they had an absent rectosphincteric reflex, and we'll talk about why that's important later on. And they had no ganglion cells in the rectal biopsy. So we'll talk about later on what we think the correct answer would be in an exam question for that case, after we talked about failure to pass meconium. So actually, meconium is described as kind of the first bowel evacuation that newborn babies have. It's worth remembering that 99% of term infants will pass meconium in 24 hours. That changes in those that are born prematurely. So 32% of premature infants will fail to pass meconium in 38 hours, but 99% of them will have passed it within 9 days. So we use this threshold of 48 hours, certainly for convenience in exams. And definitely should alert you to it being potentially pathological if an infant fails to pass meconium in the first 48 hours. But just remember that some premature infants won't pass meconium in that period of time. Why do we care about a failure to pass meconium in the first 48 hours? Because it may mean intestinal obstruction. We've talked about it in previous podcasts, but it's worth remembering what our defecation reflex is like. So remember, as with most reflexes, you've got a stimulus, which is feces entering your rectum, and this causes distension of your rectal wall. So your stimulus to go for a poo is feces entering the rectum. That causes distension of the wall of the rectum. The receptors are stretch receptors in the rectal wall, and then the afferent or sensory fibres terminate in your myenteric plexus. So these are called afferent. So remember, sensory fibres are called afferent, motor fibres are called efferent. So the myenteric plexus is the big coordination centre for your defecation reflex. You then send efferent signals that are motor signals to smooth muscle. And therefore your effectors, which are affected by your efferent fibres, are the smooth muscle cells of your descending colon, your sigmoid colon and your rectum. And then your response to all of this process is peristalsis and relaxation of your internal anal sphincter. So that's what's normal. So a lot of what we'll focus on today is what's abnormal. So a clinical presentation of meconium retention or failure to pass meconium within 48 hours is progressive abdominal distension, a refusal to feed. As you can imagine, if you're bunged up with poo and can't get rid of it, it will affect your ability to feed, and vomiting of bilious contents as well. So these are the classic signs of intestinal obstruction in neonates. Okay, with meconium retention, you may just have the distension, you may have distension and reluctance to feed, and depending on the cause, you may also get the vomiting of bilious contents. Abdominal examination is important because actually when you feel the abdomen of someone with meconium retention, you may feel visible or palpable loops of bowel that are distended. Okay, plain films can't differentiate between small and large bowel obstruction because neonates don't possess Hauschka and they develop during that first 6 months. So neonates don't have the normal folding that allows you in adults to distinguish between large and small bowel obstruction. The differentials of small bowel obstruction in this group of patients might contain duodenal atresia, you might have malrotation, so failure of the gut to rotate embryologically, a volvulus that can be associated with malrotation, and meconium ileus, and bilious vomiting tends to be the first sign of small bowel obstruction. Large bowel obstruction could be Hirschsprung's that we'll talk about today, anorectal malformations that we'll also mention, and meconium plugs. Okay, so we're going to talk about a few conditions today. We're going to talk about the more common conditions. So we're going to talk about things like Hirschsprung's, meconium plug syndrome, meconium ileus, and anorectal malformations. We're not going to talk about the much more rare things because they're not very applicable for examination purposes. So the most important condition that we're going to talk about today is the most common cause of neonatal bowel obstruction, which is Hirschsprung's disease. So it happens in 1 in every 4,000 live births. It's 4 times more common in boys, and 8% of those of patients with Hirschsprung's will have Down syndrome. So it's got syndromic associations as well. The giveaways in single best answer questions will often involve failure to pass meconium in the first 48 hours. You will tend to have a narrow rectum and it will be empty of stool, and we'll talk about why that is later on, where you've got no stool in the rectum. And you will often have a transition zone on your barium enema. Okay, a transition between, you know, where the bowel is working normally and where it's not working normally, but it's absent in 25% of cases. And it was actually absent in our case that we were talking about. So what an investigation that you may hear about that might be entered into a question is anorectal manometry. So if you have got a newborn with symptoms of bowel obstruction, especially if you're thinking large bowel, you can look at changes of anal pressure. So what this relies on is you having ganglion cells, okay? So ganglia or innervated cells with normal innervation are really important, because when you've got ganglion cells present, when you get that normal presence of feces in the rectum and rectal distension, okay, that inhibits your internal anal sphincter. So rectal distension normally inhibits your internal anal sphincter, okay, which is called your rectosphincteric reflex. So if you've got ganglion cells present, you get rectal distension, okay, and you inhibit your internal anal sphincter. If you inhibit your internal anal sphincter, your anal pressure goes down, and that's your rectosphincteric reflex. In patients with Hirschsprung's disease, you lose your rectosphincteric reflex, okay? So that's quite important. So it's important investigations for looking at Hirschsprung's disease. If the rectosphincteric reflex is absent, you don't get that normal fall in anal pressure with rectal distension, you would think, have they got aganglionic cells, which basically means that they lacked ganglia. So you'd be thinking of Hirschsprung's disease. Even if the anorectal manometry is quite suggestive, you still need to do a rectal suction biopsy, okay, which shows no ganglion cells. So if you see that in an exam, They've had a rectal suction biopsy. They haven't passed meconium in 48 hours. And the rectal suction biopsy shows no ganglion cells. Okay, you need to think about Hirschsprung's disease. And in patients with Hirschsprung's disease, the management is slightly different by different centres, but often it will require a colostomy and you'll pull through, in some occasions, do a pull through procedure. But normally a colostomy is initially placed for decompression and they can have corrective surgery 3 to 6 months. So Hirschsprung's disease is characterised or kind of defined by an absence of ganglion cells in the distal colon and the rectum. So why does it happen? We either think it's a failure of your neuroblasts, which are in neural crest cells, to migrate into the bowel segments, or degeneration destruction of neuroblasts that have already migrated there. It affects cells in your myenteric and submucosal plexus, and we talked about the importance of the myenteric plexus as the central coordinator of your defecation reflex earlier on in this podcast. So you get functional obstruction because you get spasm in the colon that lacks ganglion cells. Ganglion cells are important for innervation, okay? Neurological innervation of that area of the body. So we can anatomically divide it into different types, but I won't go through that now, and it's just dependent upon the area that's involved. So that's Hirschsprung's disease. So it's the most common cause of neonatal bowel obstruction. It's really critical for the case that we've talked about today, and we'll talk about why some of the features in our case would suggest that that is the most likely diagnosis, if that was an exam question. Meconium plug syndrome is very mild, and it's one of the more common types of functional obstruction. So what tends to happen is that you have got meconium that plugs, and that's basically it. So you've got meconium just forming a plug. So it's incidence wise, you can talk about 1 in 500, which if you compare it to Hirschsprung's and 1 in 4,000, it's more common. So if you were to do an abdominal film, you would probably just see generalized distension of intestinal loops. That can be small and large bowel, but again, it's really difficult to choose the difference because they lack the normal folds. Okay. The contrast enema or barium enema is really important because it will show the outline of the plug. And sometimes rectal stimulation, different places say different things, but sometimes a thermometer, okay, or a saline enema used by different people induces passage of the plug. So sometimes just that stimulation can help you pass the plug. After you pass the plug, the bowel movements are normal and all the symptoms get better, okay? So in most cases of meconium plug syndrome, once you pass the plug, you're absolutely fine. So it's a functional form of obstruction due to a meconium plug, okay? And it's usually transient. It gets better when you pass the plug, and it tends to affect your left colon, okay? So it's got associations with things like maternal diabetes and cystic fibrosis. Meconium ileus makes up 30% of your intestinal obstruction in newborns. So again, another really common type. It's 50% of meconium ileus, your gut is undamaged. Okay, 50% meconium ileus, your gut is undamaged. So you'll find in different textbooks, some will say that Hirschsprung's is the most common type of intestinal obstruction. Other places will say meconium ileus, because you're looking at Hirschsprung's 25 to 30%, meconium ileus 25 to 30%. So as long as you remember that meconium ileus and Hirschsprung's disease are the two to remember from this podcast, you won't go far wrong. So cystic fibrosis is the underlying disorder in most patients with meconium ileus. That's a critical thing to remember. So if you've got a patient, we'll go through some cases at the end, a patient with meconium ileus, the most likely underlying disorder is cystic fibrosis. And with meconium ileus, one of the things that I was told that has always stuck with me is actually the consistency of the meconium is more likely to be abnormal in meconiumitis versus meconium plug syndrome. And meconiumitis occurs in about 15% of those with cystic fibrosis. So meconiumitis, neonatal bowel obstruction of the distal ileum usually. So it's due to abnormally thick and impacted meconium. So actually, meconiumitis, you're more likely to have meconium that is abnormal in consistency, whereas meconium plug syndrome, you can have normal meconium forming a blockage, so the consistency is normal. So that's important. So meconium, what is it? Because it's critical to understand what meconiumitis is. So it's made up of things like bile salts, bile acids, and debris from your intestinal mucosa, and is usually evacuated within 6 hours, sometimes earlier. Meconiumitis is when the meconium becomes inspissated. Okay, all that word means is that the meconium becomes thick and heavy. An obstructional distal ileum. It's usually associated with cystic fibrosis. 15 to 20% of infants with cystic fibrosis will present with meconiumitis at birth. Okay, so that's an important thing. So if you think meconiumitis, think cystic fibrosis. Any hint in the question about cystic fibrosis and failure to pass meconium, think about meconiumitis. So it usually presents with abdominal distension at birth. When they swallow air, it becomes worse and they can have bile-stained vomit and thickened bowel loops, palpable bowel loops. So on a plain radiograph, it can be non-specific and it can show dilated bowel loops. Okay, barium enema usually shows a microcolon. Okay, so that can involve the whole of the large bowel, because remember, this is a distal ileal obstruction. So if you think about it, your distal ileum is the last bit of your small bowel and is just before you get to your ileocecal junction. So your ileocecal junction is the passageway between your small and large bowel. So it's completely unsurprising that you would get a microcolon involving the whole large bowel, okay? Because where's the problem? The problem is distal ileum in meconium ileus. If you want to remember meconium ileus, think of ileum. So meconium ileus affects the distal ileum. Okay, so you will get a microcolon normally involving the whole of the large bowel because it affects your distal ileum. Your distal ileum and your ileocecal junction is the gateway between your small and large bowel. Anal rectal malformations are something to think about. So if you've got something like anal stenosis, this is when your anus is very small. So the thing that is a giveaway in exams is a ribbon-like stool. Because the anus is usually very small, there is an anal opening there, but you can't pass large amounts of stool. You can only squeeze small amounts of poo through it, so they will get ribbon-like stools. In anal atresia, you have no anus, and your rectum ends in a fistula. Okay, and anal rectal malformations are associated with Vacterol syndrome. So 70% of patients with anal rectal malformations will have associations with other problems. So Vacterol is a mnemonic that stands for V for vertebral defects, A for anal atresia, which is what we're talking about, C for cardiac defects, T for tracheoesophageal fistula, E for esophageal atresia, R for renal defects, and L for limb hyperplasia that normally affects your upper limbs. Small left colon syndrome is a form of transient dysmotility in your descending colon. And if you ever see an exam question with small left colon syndrome, it's much more common in infants of diabetic mothers, and 50% of cases of small left colon syndrome are due to being an infant of a diabetic mother. You will get ganglion cells in your rectal biopsy. So a rectal biopsy is a way of distinguishing it between that and Hirschsprung's. When we take a rectal biopsy, we do it 2 centimetres above your dentate line, because the region below your dentate line is normally aganglionic. So if you were to do a rectal biopsy at the dentate line or just below, it would be of no use in the diagnosis of Hirschsprung's because those cells are normally aganglionic. You then take it above the dentate line because these cells are ganglionic. So if these cells above the dentate line are aganglionic, you're thinking Hirschsprung's. Back to our case. So born at 40 weeks gestation, weight 3.5 kilograms, normal delivery, no complications, no history of mum being diabetic. Did not pass meconium within 40 hours, had some vomiting and reluctance to feed. Dilated bowel with no transition zone. We said that in Hirschsprung's, 25% of those with Hirschsprung's will not have a transition zone. So it's probably what's happening in this case. Absent rectosphincteric reflex, that we said your rectosphincteric reflex requires ganglion cells. There were no ganglion cells in the rectal biopsy. So for case that we talked about in the beginning of the podcast, the answer in a single best answer question would be Hirschsprung's disease. So now we've got some final questions to go up on. So question number one, underlying disorder in an infant with meconium ileus for question number one. For question number two would be infant of diabetic mother fails to pass meconium question mark. So let's go through the first two questions. So underlying disorder in an infant with meconium ileus is cystic fibrosis. An infant of diabetic mother who fails to pass meconium would be small left colon syndrome. And then we've got a few more. A two-year-old with chronic constipation, ineffective laxatives, fails to pass meconium in the first 48 hours of life, explosive stools on rectal exam, and an x-ray showed very distended colon. Okay, so this is the answer. This would be Hirschsprung's disease. So Hirschsprung's disease uniformly will present usually in the first 6 months, can present in the neonatal period, it can present up to 6 months. Presentations out of this range are not unheard of, and it can present in adults. Again, the features on rectal suction biopsy are very diagnosis, and the suggestive findings on anorectal manometry of absence of the rectosphincteric reflex. So that is Hirschsprung's disease. So this, it's a continuum of presentation. It can present in the neonatal period, it can present in the age up to 6 months, and it can actually present in children of kind of 2 years old, 3 years old, and also there are case reports in adults. We're then going to go for a more classical presentation. A two-day-old boy didn't pass meconium, abdomen is slightly distended, rectal suction biopsy reveals aganglionic cells, absent rectosphincteric reflex, Hirschsprung's disease, and a much more classical presentation of that. The most accurate diagnostic test for Hirschsprung's disease in an SBA question is what? What's your idea? So it would be suction rectal biopsy. Anorectal manometry will often get put as an answer, but even if you've got patients with anorectal manometry findings of a absent rectosphincteric reflex, you still have to do the rectal suction biopsy to confirm the diagnosis of Hirschsprung's. So the most accurate diagnostic test is a suction rectal biopsy. They're often put in things like plain radiographs. Plain radiographs can tell you that there's bowel dilatation and can hint towards bowel obstruction. But knowing the exact etiology and confirm that it's Hirschsprung's requires a suction rectal biopsy. So don't get distracted in exams. The answer is suction rectal biopsy. Don't put anorectal manometry and don't put plain abdominal films or anything like that, because you need to actually demonstrate that there's aganglionic cells. There is a child who has got anal atresia. They've also got some vertebral defects, some cardiac defects, a tracheoesophageal fistula, renal anomalies and limb defects. So the diagnosis would be vactoral. So this is a vactoral association. Remember, syndromes are sets of features that you would expect assigned to, for example, fetal alcohol syndrome, Down syndrome. There's certain clinical signs you would expect to find. Associations are defects that are associated with each other. So this is why it's vactoral association, not vactoral syndrome, because these are defects that have an association with each other. So I hope today has been very useful. The main thing we've covered is failure to pass meconium. And the thing that I want you to remember for today is Hirschsprung's disease and how it would present. But be aware of the other things such as meconium ileus and its association with cystic fibrosis, meconium plug as well, and be aware that sometimes actually anorectal malformations are associated with failure to pass stool. Anal stenosis would give you ribbon-like stools. Anal atresia, you can't pass stools at all. And both of these anorectal malformations are associated with Vactoral, which is vertebral, anal atresia, cardiac defects, tracheoesophageal fistula, esophageal atresia, the American spelling without the O, renal anomalies, and limb defects. Thank you very much for tuning in today.